Well, good morning, church. It is so good to see you on yet another beautiful Sunday morning. It was last Sunday, I thought, was just a really great Sunday to get to have family in and to have some folks back that we hadn't gotten to see in a while. And all y'all were all dressed up and looked real nice for once. And I was real proud. Y'all put on, that's the way I always dress. It was really good to see you all. And some of you commented that I did wear a suit last Sunday. And they're like, you should always wear a suit. But then Easter rolls around, and I got nothing better. Now that's it. Easter rolls around, and I'm just like, it's the same thing he wears every week. Why didn't he dress up this week? So now you know when I wear a suit, it's a special occasion. Special occasion yesterday, I was really fortunate to be the last-minute fill-in preacher for Andy and Allison's wedding, and that was just a really neat thing. If you get to see Andy around town, Andy Dong and his new wife Allison, tell them congratulations. They're a really special couple. Really thankful for that. Thankful for the relationship that Hayden and the prophets developed with Andy over the years, and their role in bringing him to Christ, and now this new Christian family together. It was just a really neat thing. I am always thankful for the importance of family. I am thankful this morning. We had a great week with Jonathan. He got a job for the summer, and he found out he made the band. So we were like so proud of him and everything. But this morning, my 16-year-old daughter is filling in for my wife. My wife got her second COVID shot on Friday, and now she is sick. It's the 5G. It's making her all sick, and she is in bed, and so she's better some today, but for those of you who know that sometimes the vaccination can make you sick for a day or two, and that's what she's going through. And so we were wondering who's going to be able to teach this class, and my 16-year-old daughter volunteered to do that. So I'm super proud of her this morning. And you probably have family members you're really proud of as well. When I was growing up, I had one of the toughest, scariest, orneriest men you can imagine in my family. He was a Texas state trooper when I was a kid, and he wore that uniform and gun like he was born into it. And, I mean, it was just like it was a part of him. It was who he was. And then about the time I became a teenager, he was promoted and became a Texas Ranger. This is a picture of him earlier in his Texas Ranger career. And that was like a huge moment of pride for our family. It was a really big deal. He had wanted to be a Texas Ranger for years, but it's really difficult to get in there. And so when he finally made that, it was a big deal for us. The Texas Rangers are said to be the oldest state law enforcement agency in North America. The Rangers were first formed in 1823 when Stephen F. Austin recruited these 10 tough and talented militiamen to help him ward off the brutal attacks that were taking place down in the Mexican province of Tejas. And so that's when they began. And these men who were believed to have been volunteers, they had to provide their own arms, their own horses. It was everything. You just are willing to do it, and then you do it yourself. They were the called upon to handle like the toughest assignments, usually in conflicts in which they were far outnumbered. That's what made them such a part of Texas history and Texas lore. They were the only group to ride to the Alamo in response to Travis's final plea for help. One of the best-known Rangers was a guy named John S. Ford, but everybody called him Rip, his name Rip stood for Rest in Peace. And he was a medical doctor, he was a newspaper editor, he was a politician, and he was a Ranger. And in his memoirs, Ford later described the kind of men who served under him in the Rangers. And this is what he said. He said, it was a company of sober and brave men. They knew their duty and they did it. While in a town, they made no braggadocio demonstration. They did not gallop through the streets, shoot and yell. They had a species of moral discipline which developed moral courage. They did right because it was right. This sort of eventually grew into what became the motto of the Rangers. They did right because it was right. And I want you to think just for a moment about that statement. Does that statement describe us, describe the church in your mind? More specifically, does it describe you? Do you do right because it is right, or do you do right because you don't want to get caught doing wrong? One of the primary reasons that ghost towns became ghost towns was because selfish and ignoble men chose to twist this code of the West into a code that better suited their own devices. Instead of doing right because it was right, they made the notion of might equals right. Whatever worked to their benefit, if you were strong enough to take it, you did it. And that became their code of the West. But we, as the people of God, are not supposed to do that. We are not supposed to take that force that way. We're not just looking out for number one. But if we're not just looking out for number one, which is, again, the old code of the West, what is our nature supposed to be? What are we supposed to be doing? Well, Jesus described it in his Sermon on the Mount when he said he said, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven." Now, in order to understand the context of this set of words, and this is, we're continuing our study through the Sermon on the Mount, we need to back up just a little bit and remember what we talked about last week in the previous verses. Remember the first 10 verses of this chapter, Matthew 5, are known as the Beatitudes because they are some of the best known passages in all of Scripture. And blessed are, blessed are those. That's the Beatitudes. But beginning here in verse 11, there is a shift in audience, or at least in the way Jesus addresses these audience, because no longer does he say, "Blessed are those." Instead, in verse 10, in verse 11, he says, "Blessed are you." He starts really bearing down on them. He is directing his words right at his disciples. It's almost like he's turning from the broader crowd specifically to his, what we would call his apostles. He is telling them what their life is supposed to be like. And what he tells them specifically that we talked about last week is he said, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you." Guys, you're going to have to do the PowerPoint. I'm not getting anything. Thank you. "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the way they persecuted the prophets, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." So you got these two concepts together here now. You got salt and persecution. We go straight from persecution into salt and light. So what is the connection here? Is Jesus just jumping around from topic to topic? It can really feel that way. If you're reading through the Sermon on the Mount, it feels like Jesus is like, And yeah, the sky is blue. And also the national debt of Chile is 5 billion. You know, it's like he's jumping from topic to topic if you don't follow the flow of his argument. And it can really feel that right, like right here, where he goes from talking about persecution to salt and light. So what is the connection? Is there a connection at all? Well, in Herod's temple, they had a chamber of salt, an entire room dedicated to salt that was used on the ceremonial sacrifices. So like in Mark's gospel, he says, everyone will be salted with fire. And many of the ancient scribes even added to that, every sacrifice will be salted with salt. That's in Mark 9:49. Because salt was inseparably linked to sacrifice in the minds of Jesus' listeners. Salt and sacrifice go hand in hand. What about the light? What does light have to do with salt and sacrifice? Well, at the age of 12, Robert Louis Stevenson, he was looking out of his window into the dark from his upstairs window, and he was watching this man as he went along in the days when they lit the street lamps, right? Before electricity, each oil lamp had to be lit by hand. And so he's watching this man go down the street and light the lamps. And Stevenson's governess came into the room. She asked him what he was doing. And he replied, I'm watching a man cut holes in the darkness. Light is described as a form of energy that's always moving. Light has to be moving. In fact, when light ceases to move because it's been absorbed by matter, it is no longer light. It's only light as long as it's moving. When it stops, not light anymore. The Messiah, Jesus, is, of course, the true source of light. He says in John chapter 8, he says, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life, right? Jesus is the true light. So we know Jesus is the true light. And that means, what does it mean that Jesus says he's the true light? Well, John also says there was a man sent from God whose name was John. That man came for a witness, to bear witness to the light, that all through him might believe. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. So when you light an oil lamp, and this makes perfect sense, right? If you light a candle, we just think about it as a candle, for instance. If we light a candle, we put it on a candle stand, or maybe you put it up on the mantle, or maybe you put it on the center of your table. Somewhere, you want it to be out in the open. Not only for safety's sake, you don't want to catch the drapes on fire or anything, but also because that's where it gives the most benefit, right? But if you cover that flame with a bowl or a tub, the light is of no use to anyone, right? And it smothers it. It goes out. And an unlighty light, that's as useless as unsalty salt. But when you put the light on a lampstand, it can give light for everyone in the house. It's like salt at its full strength, right? And when the city on the hill lets its light shine like a lamp on a lampstand or like a full dose of salt, others see the good works and glorify God, who is the ultimate source of this light. So here we are. We are human beings made in the image of God. You were made in the image of God. I was made in the image of God. And when we, as image bearers of God, don't live up to God's image, we become useless, maybe even worse than useless. When we fail to do what we were created to do, we are not worth the paper we're printed on, so to speak. When you and I specifically, now hear us this morning, when we know Christ, but we live as though we don't, how can you and I benefit the world? That's the real question. We would be as helpful as a lamp under a bowl, as helpful as salt that's no longer salty, right? But what Jesus is saying, I believe also on the flip side, is that when the people of God, whether it's the apostles or the prophets or the modern day disciples like you and I, when we fearlessly accept that the open hostility of the world, that the world is not in our favor, in which we this world in which we live and serve, when we accept that hostility, then we have the capacity to change the world. When we live in contrast to the world, we have the capacity to change the world. Our role, your role and my role, our identity, our very purpose in creation is to be offered up as living sacrifices on behalf of everyone around us. That's what we are called to do as the church of the living God. If the house is dark, don't blame the house. That's what happens when the sun goes down. Instead, we need to ask, where's the light? If the meat goes bad, you don't blame the meat, right? That's what happens when bacteria breeds unchecked. Instead, we need to be asking, where's the salt? And if a society, even our society, becomes corrupt, becomes broken, becomes sinful and wild and untamed, our first tendency is to ask, what is wrong with them? Why don't they do what's right? How can I make them do what is right? But that is not our role. Our role is not to blame the world for being the world. That's just what happens. That's what happens when fallen man is left to himself. When human evil lives in our world, that is what happens. And we cannot, unlike the Texas Rangers, we don't get to go around enforcing the laws of God on those who are not living under that covenant. Instead, we need to ask, where are the Christians? It is not the world's fault for being the world. It is our fault for not living as light in a dark world, for not living as salt in an unsalted world. It is hypocritical of us to shrug our hands in despair or to point fingers of blame at our society for going bad. Jesus told us, you and me, the light, the salt, the law providers, he told us to be the salt and light. And when we are not salt and light, it gets dark and goes bad. Now we look out at our world and we're like, oh, what is wrong with America? It is getting dark and going bad. Whose fault is that? I'll give you a hint. It's not America's fault. It is our fault for not living as salt and light. If darkness and rottenness abound, then we have to accept the blame and accept with new determination the role that Jesus has given us to live not as the world lives, but to live as he's called us. To live not as Americans or Democrats or Republicans or rich or poor. We're not living as any of that. We are living as children of God. We're not subscribers to a national policy or political ideology or economic situation. That is not our role. That is not who we are. You are a son of God. You are a daughter of God. That is your role. It is because you are son and daughter of God that you live as a husband or a wife or a son or a daughter or an employer or an employee or a political being. Everything is driven by relationship to God. And that, frankly, that puts us in contrast with the rest of the world around us. It makes me behave as a husband differently than the people who live around me, as a father differently than those who are around me. It makes me behave as an employee differently than those who are around me, as a political being differently, as an economic being differently. I don't think of money the way everybody else thinks of money. I don't think of politics the way everybody else thinks of politics. I don't think of my wife the way everybody else thinks of my wife. And that's probably really good. But I don't think of the world around us the way the world around us thinks of itself, right? Because we are not the meat. We are not the dark. We are the salt and we are the light. This morning, I want to encourage you to think about your relationship with the world. Have you been more concerned with pointing fingers or more concerned with living as salt and light? We want to offer up this encouragement. For the last few months, we have not been extending an invitation. We've been very conscious of trying to keep people as socially distanced as safely possible, and we're still trying to do that as best we can here in the gym. But we're going to start offering an invitation. All of the elders have been vaccinated, and I've been vaccinated, and so we feel very comfortable. If you have a prayer need or a need that you'd like to share with the congregation to be prayed over, to be prayed about, we want to lift you up. If you're ready to become a child of God, we don't want you to have to delay any longer. And if there is any way we can help you this morning, we want to encourage you to come now as we stand and as we sing.